You're listening to All Marine Radio, broadcasting from Costa Mesa, California, on the All Warrior Radio Network. Continue here on a Monday morning, All Marine Radio. Thanks for tuning in, and privileged to be joined this morning by an Irishman, and he's a smart one, no less. But Aaron O'Connell. First of all, Aaron, what's the B stand for in your middle name?
Yeah, that's classified. I don't really know that kind of information.
Come on, give it up. You have to. You know, I know it's goofy. There's not too many cool names that start with B.
Right. It's a very strange middle name. It's my mother's maiden name, and it's Bro, B-R-E-A-U-L-T, which doesn't look like it's spelled Bro at all, but this is a source of endless fascination for my brother, who has a traumatic brain injury, so he sometimes takes comfort in little things, and he loves the fact that his brother's name is actually Bro, and he laughs about that every day.
That's awesome. I knew. Let me just tell you. I feel your pain. My middle name is Francis.
And I'm sorry.
No, it wasn't okay until the Pope we have now just got enthroned.
Yes, that's right.
Exactly. So now when they say Francis, and I say, yeah, Francis, like
that's
the Pope.
Right. Proudly like, so.
Like the Pope. Aaron, first of all, brought you on this morning to talk about one of your books, and very impressed with some of the stuff you've written. I'd love to have you back to talk about what you wrote about Afghanistan. I found that very interesting as well. The moving in the mountains, so cultural friction, and saw it there a little bit, and saw cultural friction in Iraq too. So would love to have you come back and talk about that kind of stuff. Let's talk about you first of all. Born and raised where?
Norwalk, Connecticut. Same place as Philip Caputo, Marine and author of A Rumor of War.
Wow, I read that.
Same hometown. Yeah, great that. Book.
It was an awesome book about Vietnam. How does the Marine Corps, first of all, where do you go to college?
I did my undergraduate at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut,
mm-hmm.
and then I did my PhD at Yale.
Okay, so how does the Marine Corps get on your radar?
That's an interesting story. I grew up in a house with a lot of war stories. My mother lost her father and her grandfather in World War II. So I grew up always knowing about that, one in the Pacific, one in Europe. But they were all Army. And so I grew up, you know, fascinated by World War II. This was before Band of Brothers. So
right.
The same basic set of stories that I was always interested in. And then it's a very strange transition from there. When I was 14 years old, I saw Top Gun, which has nothing to do with the Marines. But that further convinced me that the military was something I wanted to pursue. And then once it came to picking a service, I was only interested in the best, and I was only interested in the hardest service. And so that led me, like, irrevocably and only towards the Marines. And then after joining, I found that interesting of how I had been so influenced by popular culture and by the stories of what Marines were in the Reagan administration when I was a young boy.
Right.
And so that actually got me interested in the topic that I ended up writing the book about, which is Marine Corps culture and the stories Marines tell themselves and tell other people about themselves.
Now, I'm afraid to ask this, but I feel morally obligated. What scene in Top Gun did you find so influential I pray to God it's not the volleyball game, okay? So is there a scene in Top Gun that you can say, yeah, it's this scene in Top Gun that really hit me like a sledgehammer?
You know, actually, I think it was the first 10 minutes, right? And I don't want to put in a plug for Kenny Loggins, because as a musician, you know, I feel like that I wouldn't put him above the Beatles.
Thank you. I was going to say that. We started this with the Beatles, so be careful.
But I think that, you know, it was very adventurous and exciting to me. And then I later found out, and I published an article about this. I found out later that Top Gun was the first film that the Navy not only gave full permission for the use of its aircraft carriers and all right. these shots and the use of their equipment, but because the producers, because Jerry Bruckheimer and Ridley Scott knew they wouldn't be able to make the movie unless the Navy approved it, they let the Navy approve the script in advance. So they didn't even pitch the script to the studios until the Navy had bought off on, signed off on, and made appropriate changes to the script. And I thought that was really interesting that, you know, these fabulous films that we grow up with that give us our stories of what the military is, sometimes there's a partnership going on there between the film industry and military recruiting, and that certainly was the case with Top Gun, and it was part of the way that they got over the negative public relations of the Vietnam War when Top Gun came out in 1986.
Wow, so you're rolling around in Connecticut, the Nutmeg State, I know.
Indeed.
And why would I know that? Because I have friends from Connecticut, Marine friends, and you know, when you're limited, I'm from California. When we want to talk shit about California, we pretty much have an open wallet in terms of, we have Snoop Dogg out here, okay? We have Sierra Nevadas, we have Los Angeles, the entertainment industry, beautiful coastline. Connecticut, restricted, I think, to the Nutmeg State, if I'm not mistaken. So I have friends from the state, and so you don't see too much Marine stuff there. So you just knew of the Marine Corps through reading, and I was introduced to the Marine Corps by the Scholastic Book Club that had a whole series of books for kids when I was going to grammar school in the 60s and 70s about World War II. And I learned about the heroism of the Marine Corps from the Scholastic Book Club at St. Charles Borromeo in Sacramento, California. You're rolling around in a Nutmeg State, not too many cultural options, and so where do you get bombarded with Marine culture back in Connecticut?
Yeah, it was mostly from popular culture, mostly really? From film and television. There were other elements as well. I had a few family members who were in the Marine Corps. You know, when people think of Connecticut, they tend to think of, like, you know, Gilmore Girls and very, very wealthy towns with people who sort of have British accents. That's less than half of Connecticut. And actually,
who knew?
Even though that's the sort of the image in popular culture, if you travel through Connecticut, you will typically go from a very wealthy white town, mm-hmm. and then you will go into a town with lots of diversity, with problems in the schools, with problems of poverty. And then you'll go next door to another town with a fantastic public school, and, you know, you have to look far and wide to see somebody who doesn't look like they belong in a Brooks Brothers catalog. So there's more diversity to Connecticut than most people think, I guess is what I'm saying.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. And so you joined the Marine Corps. What's your MOS in the Marine Corps? You're still in, right?
Correct. I'm a reservist now. I did 5 years on active duty, and then I joined the reserve thereafter. So I started as a 1302 combat engineer. And I joined in 1995, so I served from 95 until 2000 on active duty, and then I went into the reserves, and at that point I was getting a PhD, and so I think for just the reasons of the fact of higher education, I started getting slotted into strategist billets, or policy and planning, or, you know, J5 stuff. So I did a number of years working out at Mark IV Pack in mm-hmm. their policy and international affairs shop. And then I started getting picked up for these different kinds of commander's action groups and strategic initiatives groups, which are typically advanced degree people who write for general officers. So I've done that since all the way until till 2014. I was doing that first for the Commandant of the Marine Corps and his Strategic Initiatives Group.
Uh-huh.
And then I did so for General Petraeus out in Afghanistan, something called the Commander's Initiatives Group. And then I did it for the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in something called the Chairman's Action Group. So that's been most of my reserve work since I started graduate school. And now I'm fully in my element. I'm a field historian with the Marine Corps History Division down in Quantico. So same job in civilian life and in my reserve work.
Awesome. Now let's talk about your civilian job. You're now a professor. I don't know. I'm not sure if I have the title right, but are you a full professor at the Naval Academy?
I'm not a full. No, I'm an associate professor, which is the middle rank. There's only three ranks, which is assistant, which is before tenure, and then associate professor once you have tenure. And then when you're just senior and distinguished and you've written many books, you become a full professor. So I'm in the middle stage.
All right. Well, you know, as a Marine officer, you know what we expect, right? Soon you'll be running the place, and we don't expect anything less. Talk to us. I have two questions for you, just but a couple of targets of opportunity. One, you've part of the history division, and how I won't say ironic. I'm not exactly sure how unanticipated this controversy over the flag raising of Iwo Jima is. The reconciliation that the Marine Corps is still in the process of going through, I think. I don't know if crazy is the right word, but what an interesting study, in my opinion, in post-combat related mental health, because I don't believe for a second that John Bradley didn't know that wasn't him in that sculpture. And, you know, his costume on Iwo Jima is so unique that I'm sure I understand it was intense and all that, but you don't forget how you put your stuff together. You don't forget how you went to work every day. I don't care, you know, who you are in the Marine Corps and what you went through. You know, and hell, if I gave you your stuff that you put together in 1995, your war belt, you'd put it together probably about 95% in the same way that you did at that time. Because for whatever reason, we were fixated on stuff like that. And then I also think, you know, Harold Schultz, he goes back and becomes a mailman. And he never says a word. It's just, to me, tremendously interesting study, post-combat-related mental health, how guys cope with them. Just as a historian, you know, your thoughts on that whole event and that whole controversy.
It is fascinating. Of course, it's not the first controversy about the flag raising, and I'm sure most of your listeners know that there were two flag raisings, and they created a great stir because people were worried that one of the flag raisings was staged. This created a bit of a kerfuffle in the early Bond tour. But I think there's a few points to take away from this recent revelation. One of them is kudos to the Marine Corps for an honest and thoughtful appraisal of what is perhaps its most important image. I mean, this is the most reproduced photograph in the world. I don't know if every of your listeners know that. It's absolutely.
Well, can I tell you something about that? Can I tell you? We're not sure if that's true. Or if it's just a Marine Corps claim, because you know how those, and we're going to talk about it later, sometimes those things intersect our own mythology with what's actually true. Is it the most reproduced?
Well, I think where the data point comes from is it's one of the few, if the only photograph that was turned into a postage stamp. So all the postage stamps are almost never photographed. And they've printed millions upon millions of the Iwo Jima stamps, so it might be an easy way to make your statistic work. And actually, I guess if you want to be fair about it, that's right, which is that the stamp itself is not the actual photograph. They didn't just copy the photograph. They made a depiction of the photograph. So you can't say it's the most reproduced photograph, but you could perhaps say it's the most reproduced image.
All right.
But fair enough.
Fair enough.
As a historian, I must never just grab willingly onto the facts I like without substantiating them. So I'll back away from that claim until I do further research.
Well, hey, we're okay with it. Just so you know, we're on board. I've always wondered, is that true or is it part of who we are?
Right. The point is, it's an incredibly important image to the Marine Corps, and when an investigation began to see if this were the case. The Marine Corps didn't try to hush it up. The Marine Corps didn't sort of say, that doesn't matter, don't lose sight of things, right? They embraced the pursuit of the truth, even about something deeply cherished by the Corps. And I have a good deal of respect for that, because I can tell you, you can go to other places all around the world where people are intent on manipulating history, and the Marine Corps doesn't actually have the best track record in this regard in the past. We can get into some of the mythologies of Marine Corps history if you like. But on this instance, they certainly put the facts first, and I commend them for it.
All right. What is there a part of that that whole identification process that intrigues you more than any other?
For the image, for the photograph?
Yeah, of the whole kind of drama that has played out from the an Irish historian, Stephen Foley, who I had on the program. He's laid up by a hernia. He has all this time to burn. That's the genesis of this, along with a wardrobe consultant, 10 years or so ago, making a comment to Sergeant Major Deaver, who's doing technical consulting on Flags of Our Fathers, saying, hey, this doesn't look right. This Bradley guy's in this, and then he's in this. I guess it doesn't. But this is him, though, because they confirmed that.
Right.
Is there a part of this whole story that you find most intriguing as a historian?
Well, it is. It's a wonderful validation of something that we all learn in officer candidate school or boot camp, and you kind of sometimes wonder if we've got the emphasis misplaced. Right? There's an almost monastic devotion to uniformity and uniform correctness, and this goes exactly 1/8 of an inch over this, and don't you dare mess it up, and this will be worn exactly so, right?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, when we're all suffering through that while people are screaming at us, there's got to be some part of us that says, for God's sake, what difference does it make? Well, how did they figure out the truth in this story? It's because of exactly what were the people wearing? What did they say? What pictures do we have of them wearing things earlier in the day? Could this be the same as that? No, those two things are different, right? So,
right.
I don't know, I find that amusing.
Right. No, I do too. We were talking, and we'll get into it here in a bit, but we're so different from, it looked, at least outwardly, the organization that went ashore repeatedly in the Pacific. I have one more general question for you, and then because of your some of the writing you've done, and it's a big question, so you can give me whatever kind of answer you want. If I pull a string from Vietnam through Lebanon, through Somalia, through Afghanistan, in Iraq, without a whole lot of study, I would tell you that the United States of America has problems wielding military power as an instrument of international politics and national power. Why? How does it seem that we as a nation have lost the vision of what it takes to win Phase 4, winning the peace, which is the reason you go to war in the first place? So we seem extremely willing to go to war and intervene in certain cases, but not to stay the course and achieve our ultimate ends. Do you have an opinion about that?
I do. I think one way to start answering that question is to separate out differences between the wars we always like to start with as the examples of successes, and then we can get into the more problematic examples you mentioned. So let's just work with the 20th century.
Right.
So the ones we love to talk about are World War I and World War II. These are the wins, right?
Right.
No question.
No question.
They were also, in just about every way, total wars. Total mobilization of societies towards specific military end states that, in more cases than not, ended up nearly destroying society, right? We bombed between 50 and 90% of 67 Japanese cities into ruin, making little, if any, and often no distinction between civilians and combatants by the end of World War II.
Right. Right?
We are using every element of power to compel surrender. And so it's not terribly unsurprising that when surrender comes in that situation, you have a definitive win. Once you get past World War II, we not only have never declared war again in a formal sense, as in Congress declaring war with a declaration, but you also start using the military for far more limited means. And there's a reason for this. Part of it is that we now have weapons that are so destructive that they would end all life on the planet. And so there are limitations on how we use military power because we value living things on the planet and we don't want a nuclear war. But we also start using military force in a much more titrated way. We start using little bits of military force for all kinds of purposes to support foreign policy. And you certainly see that in Lebanon. You certainly see that in Somalia. You certainly see a titrated incrementalist approach in Vietnam, which unfortunately gets by the end of the war is widely disproportionate to the ends we're trying to achieve, the amount of bombing we're doing. But the point is, we're pursuing political ends with military force. We always pursue political ends by military force, but in World War I and World War II, the political end was surrender. Total abdication of your sovereignty and your right to govern your society and surrender to us, and then we will determine the path and the route to peace. When you're pursuing an absolutist goal like that, then increases in violence can produce your end states. When you are pursuing a change in behavior, you're actually trying to use violence to change someone's mind, to change their narrative about resistance, and that oftentimes works less well, I think. That might be a start to the answer to your question. It's certainly not the end.
You know, I like that. It works less well. Well said, O'Connell. Very good. In fact, do you know Will Costantini?
I know.
Colonel, Naval Academy grad, has been on at least I know one panel back at the Naval Academy, and we were talking about this subject, and he very humorously stated, "Yes, that's a concern," and I said, "Well said, Will. That is a concern." Anyway, let's talk about your book, Underdogs: The Making of the Modern Marine Corps. Before we came on the air today, you and I were talking, and I, as a kind of an amateur, as a Marine, you know, officer, I've taught in Quantico at both the basic school and the infantry officer course. I'm a reader, got exposed to Generals Kelly and Allen, who are both voracious readers, and they turned me into a professional. Through the course of my reading, I heard General Zinni speak at the basic school when I was an instructor, and he said, pick a battle, any battle, and learn everything you can about it. Communications, how they handled the whole medical chain, what they did with dead bodies, how they, you know, handled their mortuary affairs. Learn the whole thing. So I thought, you know, I'm really interested in Iwo Jima, so I read that. So I have this collection of pictures. One of the things I find most humorous about World War II is you can't find a picture of two Marines dressed the same way, yet we are obsessed with uniformity in the modern Marine Corps. And so you look at it and you say, where the hell did that come from? You see pictures of those guys that were taken in studios in Laguna Beach before they set off on the fight in the Pacific in their dress blues. And I don't know how physically they got the cover to sit on the side of their head like they wear it. And their hair, right? Their hair, they're wearing these kind of bouffant hairstyles. And you're like, okay, so that's World War II island fighting Marine Corps. What happened? When did we start shaving our heads? When did we begin this whole, you know, uniformity, you know, craziness? And how did we get there? And so the subject of your book is in my opinion very interesting because we have a very, very interesting and crazy culture. And so when I saw the title, I was intrigued immediately. What did happen post World War II that either begins this process of us becoming a different organization, or how do we morph into today?
Sure, yeah, it's a great way to start. So, as a way of answering it, let me just give some initial context, and I'll take your image of the Marine who's either already gone to World War II or is on his way over, and he's got the hair, he's got the cover tacked off to the side, and he doesn't look anything like what we expect of Marines today, right?
Right?
But in fact, the Marine Corps in 1941 was nothing like the Marine Corps of today in some of the most major ways. So just let me throw a few examples your way. First of all, they were not popular. there's a nationwide study done in November of 1941, all across the country. What service would you join? What service do you like? Which ones don't you like? They ask boys. They ask boys in college who might be officers. They ask parents. And the Marine Corps comes in dead last in every category. It is the least popular service in 1941. Parents think that Marines are rough, rowdy, and tough. They think that if their sons joined, they'd be involved with, this is a great quote, the least desirable associate. And they want nothing to do with the Marine Corps. Who comes in first, you might add? It's actually anything that flies. They don't even know Marines have aviation at this time. So it's Naval Aviation and the Army Air Forces later, the Army Air Corps later become the Army Air Forces. That's what the young boys like. They are not interested in the Marine Corps. So the Marine Corps is unpopular. It actually isn't terribly well-disciplined. Roughly one in five people who joined the Marine Corps in 1941 have a minor police record. And they also have almost no power inside the National Defense Establishment. So I'll just do a couple comparisons between then and now to give your readers or your listeners a sense. So in 1941, 3% of the active duty services are Marines. The Marines make up just 3% of the entire active duty force. Today it's about five times that, 15% of the active duty force. In 1941, at the start of 1941, there's nothing above a major general. The commandant is the major general commandant. So they have almost no role in strategy conversations. They have no access to the president whatsoever. They're entirely under the Secretary of the Navy, and the CNO, a four-star, can shut down the two-star major general commandant anytime he wants. They also don't have any legislative protections. Yes, they've been a separate service by some arguments since 1798, by other arguments since 1834. But as far as the Navy's concerned, the Marines are a part of the Navy. The Navy buys their planes, the Navy pays for all their aviation maintenance, and the Navy can really tell the Marines what to do in a lot of circumstances. That, there's no comparison to the role of the Marine Corps today in American society or politics or inside the defense establishment. We have a chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff who's a United States Marine, and he's the second Marine to be a JCS chairman. In the 1940s, if you told an admiral, once we had created the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the chairman's position, if you said there's going to be a Marine at the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, they would have laughed you out of the room. That was unthinkable, that this subset of the Navy in their mind would somehow occupy the senior military position in the country. They had a series of legislative protections now, which they earn in the period that I write about, whereby Congress can't actually, or neither the Congress nor the President can reduce their role in national defense or shrink their forces. And of course, by this point, they're so popular, they've been the Marine Corps has the most successful brand in the American military today. They've been rated the most prestigious service in poll after poll year on end since the 1980s. So the question is, how did it get that way? Right? How do you go from unpopular, politically disempowered, both inside the DOD or the defense establishment and inside American politics, to the rather impressive brand and the detailed networks of political power that the Marine Corps has today? And when I started thinking about that and writing about that, I realized that, yeah, World War II is part of that story. No question. The battles are part of that story. The Iwo Jima flag raising is part of that story. But that's only a small part of the story. And then if you really want to understand how the Marines get so powerful, you have to look at how they deployed their brand and their stories about themselves into the realm of public relations, into the press, into Hollywood, into Congress, and even inside the strategic circles in the United States military. And that's how I ended up writing the book.
Could you take us to 1946, 1947? And because he's a retired Marine major. He's a tanker. Joined the Marine Corps in 1947, and tells this incredible story about being a tanker at the Chosin Reservoir and the landing at Incheon. But he talks about his recruiter made him sign a paper saying that he understood that he would revert to the United States Army in the event that the Marine Corps was disestablished or shrunk to the size that, you know, and he said, I signed a paper in 1947 saying that it might have not been 47, it might have been 49 when he reenlisted or something like that. Could you paint a picture of that period in terms of the real discussion about the future of the United States Armed Forces and what people really wanted to do with the Marine Corps, people in power?
Sure, yeah. It's a major and important story. So by the end of World War II, we have much more military than we need. In fact, we have much more military than we can afford. There's upwards of 10 million people in uniform. The Marine Corps has grown to almost 500,000. It's got way more than can be sustained. And the Army is rightfully concerned about what looks like a second land army. Remember, before World War II, the Marines didn't even have divisions, right? The 1st Marine Division isn't created until World War II. So because of this, the Army is saying, well, wait a minute. You're not going to ever really have to seize islands again. They did not see Korea coming, obviously. You're never going to have to do an amphibious operation again because now there's nuclear weapons. And if our enemies have nuclear weapons, and we assume they will at some point, then how can you converge on a beach and discharge landing troops without the defenders just atomizing you? So you really don't need a Marine Corps anymore. In fact, what we need to do is not have a separate War Department and a separate Navy Department. We need to create a Department of Defense. And you can keep the Marine Corps if you want to, but let's be clear about this. They don't need their own aviation. Give that to what's going to become the Air Force. They certainly don't need anything of division size. They can have regiments. They can go back to being landing parties on ships. Well, this is not met with any enthusiasm by the Marine Corps, as you can imagine, nor by the Navy, because they're worried about losing their naval aviation. So from 1946 until 1949, there's a series of reorganizations, which are collectively referred to as unification, when we unified the separate War and Navy departments into the Department of Defense. And there's a series of fights that happen, real political fights, about what we're going to do with the various services. And this is one of the chapters in the book, is explaining how the Marines got so powerful inside of Congress and really did amazing things, because if there is a winner in the unification fight, it is, without question, the tiny Marine Corps, which had the least number of veterans in Congress, it had the least political power, it had very small numbers, and yet they managed not only to save their Marine aviation and save their division, but in the end, later in the early 50s, they get a series of protections written in so that this can't ever happen again. So we all know there are three divisions and three air wings. What your listeners might not know is that the Marine Corps is the only service that has a congressionally mandated floor. They cannot be reduced below three divisions and three air wings. And that's remarkable, that Congress would reach into the president's power. The president is the commander-in-chief. He has the right to structure the armed forces as he sees fit to fight and win the nation's wars. And Congress reached in and said, we don't care what your military wants to do. Nobody's going to take away the Marine divisions or the Marine air wings. And that's because of active, very creative lobbying by the Marine Corps in the late 1940s.
My guest this morning is Aaron O'Connell. He's a Marine officer, currently a reserve officer. He's an assistant professor at the United States Naval Academy. And we're fortunate enough to have him on this morning talking about a book he's written, Underdogs, The Making of the Modern Marine Corps. The first of all, Aaron, you can get it on Amazon, yes?
You sure can, yeah.
Okay. And so it's interesting because politics now dominating, you know, just about everything that we read. How in the hell did they pull that off? Because honestly, because, you know, what motivates a politician is normally what's going back on in the district. How is it polling and things like that? But this is maybe before that day. But certainly, how does the Marine Corps, being so small, pull off that kind of coup, essentially, relative to national military power? Because I don't know that you could describe it as anything else other than a coup. Like, what have they got now? I can only imagine if you were part of the Department of the Army watching this, Eisenhower watching this, going, you've got to be kidding me. These guys are like running rogue, you know, through Washington, D.C., and getting what is going on. The world is turned upside down. So,
he used saltier language than that.
Exactly.
Both Truman and Eisenhower were not fans of the Marines, not just because they were former Army officers, but because of exactly what you described, their disproportionate power and their interference in political affairs that we typically think the military should not be involved in. So the answer to your question, how do they pull this off? There's three answers. I think all of these three things happened at once. The first is that they just worked harder than everybody else. So there's a reason I titled the book Underdog, which I think any Marine would get, right? You understand there's a reference to devil dogs in there. But also, if you think of what an underdog is, it's somebody who feels like they're always surrounded by bigger, larger adversaries, that they are at risk, they are under siege. Well, that's how the Marines have always felt. They have a deeply paranoid culture that believes everyone's out to get them. And that creates in the Marine Corps a culture of perseverance and even extremism to a degree, as Marines feel like if we don't do everything we can to protect us, even people who are ostensibly our allies, like the other services or the president or the Congress, right, other Americans, they're going to do us wrong. And we have to always, always, always protect our own. So that under siege mentality, that paranoid culture, works to great effect for the Marine Corps. And it was even stronger in this period because these were people who had just come from the island hopping campaign of the Pacific.
Right.
98% of Marine officers served overseas in World War II, and 89% of enlisted men served overseas. Right.
Wow.
They all were in combat. Or in something deeply unpleasant, like sitting on a backwards island in the middle of the Pacific, you know, for 2 years on end. But the point is, a goodly number of them had experienced pretty severe life-changing situations. And this created in them a certain tenacity about protecting the Marine Corps. And they imported those sentiments of the battlefield into their bureaucratic battles in Washington, D.C. So that's the first part, right? They were just more severe about pursuing their services protection. Number two, the second reason is, frankly, they broke the law. They broke the law quite a bit, and it's fascinating and even a little fun now, but we should call it for what it is.
There is a tradition in the Marine Corps of I don't want to say lawlessness, but it's easier to ask for forgiveness than ask for permission.
I like the word iconoclasm, right?
When right, iconoclasm, constantly. Whole staff NCOs, you know, they were, you know, when I joined the Marine Corps in 1983, and, you know, they were the organized crime element of the Marine Corps. They were burying gear
right.
during FASMO inspections. They were transferring gear in the middle of the night so that somebody didn't get relieved. You know,
right.
they were, but, and this was acceptable, and it goes back to, hey, when we left the Chosen Reservoir, we took our dead bodies, we took the Army's trucks, we repainted the numbers, right?
Right.
Nobody needs a Marine Corps, right? We have, you know, and you hear that whole lecture that goes absolutely to what you're saying, but, so we absolutely violated the law.
Right. So, yeah, we did. Now, let me be clear about this. Other services were trying to do similar things, they just weren't doing them as well. So if your readers are familiar with Brute Krulak's book, First to Fight, one of the most famous books about the Marine Corps that everybody
right,
reads, he was
right.
one of the participants in this story. And he sells it very honorably, right? He actually has a chapter called The Honorable Art of Institutional Theft, where he's describing how, hey, sometimes you got to work around the rules, you know? But let me be clear what happened. So as Congress is trying to adjudicate this bill on unifying the War Department and the Navy Department to create what will become the Department of Defense, President Truman, the Commander-in-Chief, says, this is my priority. No service will oppose this publicly. The Commander-in-Chief has said, this is our policy. We are pursuing this unification. And all the other services say, okay, no problem. We're on board. Even the Navy, which had a number of concerns about unification, says, we're not going to go against what the President wants us to do. A small group of very well-connected, well-educated combat veteran Marines decide they don't care. They're gonna lobby the Congress indirectly anyway. And they have a fun name. They're called the Chowder Society, with a name that they give themselves.
Where does that come from?
It comes from a comic book, which had a very short character in the name of the comic book. And the comic book was called The Little Man's Marching Drum and Chowder Society. And so one of the members of the Marine group, the author of the book I just mentioned, Victor Krulak,
right.
he's very, very short. And so they, were the Chowder Society. That's how they named themselves. But here's what they did. So the first thing is they dressed in civilian clothes so they couldn't be spotted. So they're going to Congress and they're talking to congressmen and they're saying, don't support the president's bill. You need to oppose the president's bill and here's why. And they're doing all that while wearing civilian clothes.
Right.
They copy top secret documents, Pentagon documents, and they distribute them not only to congressmen but to the reporters. That's a felony. Okay? They say, look, here's what the Army wants to do to the Marine Corps. It says right here they want to take away our aviation. They want to make sure we don't have division-sized units. So they did that. They then are ordered by the president to desist, cease and desist. He calls the commandant in. He says, you've got to get those lieutenant colonels off the hill. The commandant says, I will. They then disregard the commandant. The commandant almost gets relieved over this. They drive around with classified papers in the trunks of their cars and in their basements so that they can get reporters to write stories about what the president is doing and how it will not favor the Marine Corps. And they make a number of deals and sort of alliances with the most conservative senators. Remember, Truman's a Democrat. They're mostly working with Republicans at this time. And they get these conservative senators and conservative congressmen to oppose the bill, not because necessarily the congressman believes that it's a bad thing for national defense. They just want to embarrass President Truman. And so the Marines do all this. They do it very successfully, and in the end, they win. The bill, the original version of the bill, is defeated, and when the final version of the bill is passed, the Marine Corps manages a backdoor deal so that they write the session pertaining to the Marine Corps. They get detailed to the congressional staff and write the actual section, which is the section for the Marine Corps that says this is the Marine Corps' mission, this is what it shall do, this is what its size is. That's all written, handwritten into the bill by an active-duty United States Marine wearing civilian clothes working on the Hill. So that's the second thing they do to, in order to pull off this great coup, is that they actually cheat. They break the law. The third thing they do, which is something that's very fascinating to me, and it goes to the point you were just making about how Marines are adaptive and creative and kind of law-breaky, right, that they're iconoclasts. The Marines were very savvy of paying attention to what people were afraid of in American society. They had, as a service, if such a thing is possible, they had enormous amounts of emotional intelligence. They knew how to tune in to the to things that were concerning to people. And so they took this bureaucratic bill, this thing that nobody can relate to. Well, exactly what subsection of this new law will pertain to the military? And they turned it into a broader story about the president having too much power, which was a scary thing in the late 1940s, right? We'd just come out of the Depression in World War II, where Roosevelt vastly expanded the executive office and the state. And so they go to congressmen and they author editorials and they get people to write on their behalf saying, this is the president taking over something that should properly belong to Congress, which is deciding how the armed forces shall be structured. And so they do some really smart, savvy politicking by linking unification to stuff that has nothing to do with unification, like how much power the president should have, what are the Democrats doing, should in fact, you know, the American people, are they going to be safe if all of a sudden there's one Department of Defense and the Army is the biggest service in it? They actually accuse the Army of planning to produce a semi-fascist Prussian state. And they say, we just beat Japan and Germany, where the military had too much power in society. If you let this single Department of Defense idea go forward, we're going to have a Prussian general staff. It's insane as a concept, but it works in post-World War II America very successfully.
We're going to have to take a break, and we're going to continue this discussion, which is absolutely – you know what? Not one bit of it surprises me, by the way, which is probably sad. But anyway, I can only imagine them looking at each other and saying, well, get it done. I know, but no, get it done. I don't care. Whatever you have to do. We're going to continue. Incredibly, incredibly interesting discussion with Aaron O'Connell. And we'll do that right after this as a Monday edition of All Marine Radio continues right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.
I'm good, but I have a story, and I don't know where to start.
I'm good, but I feel alone in a crowd.
I'm good, but the past keeps coming back.
When the service member or veteran in your life says,
I'm good,
are you really listening?
I'm good, but I can't get out of bed.
I'm good, but I can't sleep.
I'm good, but I feel overwhelmed.
I'm good, but I don't feel safe.
I'm good, but I still have nightmares.
I'm good, but I don't need any help.
I'm good, but I don't feel anything anymore.
I'm good, but I can't live like this anymore.
I'm really not so good. But are you ready to listen?
Suicide prevention is everyone's responsibility. Listen to the veteran or service member in your life. If you are in crisis or know someone who is, call the Veterans Crisis Line and Military Crisis Line at 1-800-273-8255 and press 1 for free 24/7 confidential support.
This is U.S. Navy and Marine Corps veteran Montel Williams. During my 22 years of military service, I had the honor of working beside many brave service women. They are the fastest growing population of veterans, and they can be a great asset to your company. Women veterans are trained to take initiative, adapt to change, and they're quick to learn. If you're an employer or a woman veteran, call the U.S. Department of Labor at 866-487-2365 or visit careeronestop.org.
Life in the military is one of service and sacrifice. For some, that sacrifice includes physical and mental injuries or trauma that will affect their lives forever. Please join with the American Legion in recognizing and supporting our wounded warriors and their families. We need to show them that we truly are a grateful nation. We cannot allow them to be forgotten and left to fend for themselves. On Veterans Day, the nation honors the men and women who risk their lives to protect our freedom. Social Security does its absolute best to honor veterans and active duty members of the military every day by giving them the respect they deserve. For those who return home with injuries, Social Security is a resource they can turn to. If you know any wounded veterans, please let them know about Social Security's Wounded Warriors website. The Wounded Warriors website answers many commonly asked questions and shares other useful information about disability benefits, including how veterans can receive expedited processing of disability claims. Benefits available through Social Security are different than those from the Department of Veterans Affairs and require a separate application. The expedited process is used for military service members who become disabled while on active military service on or after October 1, 2001, regardless of where the disability occurs. Learn more by visiting www.socialsecurity.gov/woundedwarriors.
I had PTSD. Once I was back from Iraq, I was distant from everybody in my family. We had a reunion of our unit, and you'd hear these spouses say, "Is your husband doing that? My husband's doing that too. I thought it was just us." And really understanding that, hey, this is a common experience.
I learned more to listen to what he was saying, and that made it easier for me to understand where his pain was coming from.
Warriors should know that resources are available. Learn more at realwarriors.net.
All of us want to make a difference. As veterans, we committed to protect our country. We served and sacrificed for the things that mattered most. Those experiences shaped our lives. Now we're husbands, wives, parents, and friends. And sometimes we forget that the biggest challenge can be asking for support. The Veterans Crisis Line is here for veterans. Dial 1-800-273-8255 and press 1. It matters.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. We continue on a Monday. My guest, fellow Irishman and Marine officer, Aaron O'Connell, professor at the United States Naval Academy, author, and we're talking about his book, Underdogs, The Making of the Modern Marine Corps, and a fascinating look at how we came to be institutionally what we are, when we certainly were not that before World War II, and how we've grown, as he points out in the first half of this interview, to be the most respected brand among the services encapsulated by the Department of Defense these days. So, I have a question for you in terms of how much was a commandant involved in all of this? So these guys are circumventing the law. Was this like Watergate? Was he getting like late night briefs or something like this, but kept away from it? Or was he part and parcel of the Chowder Society?
He was not part and parcel of the Chowder Society. He was kept deliberately out of it, so that they had cover, so that effectively the head of the Marine Corps couldn't get in trouble for the things they were doing. The people who were involved, there were two generals, but most of the people were lieutenant colonels and colonels. And it's kind of funny to me because there's some interesting parallels to my own life, because they all come from a few specific institutions. A fair number of them come from the Naval Academy, where I teach but did not go. Some of them come from Yale, where I do not teach but I did go. And then there's actually some historians involved in it. So Robert Debs Heinel, who is, as he describes himself, the self-proclaimed minister of propaganda for the Chowder Society, he is a very prominent Marine historian. He's written marvelous books about the Marine Corps. Right. He's also, by just strange coincidence, a relation. I want to say he's the grandson or the grandnephew of Eugene Debs, the socialist candidate for president.
Wow. Back
in the first half of the 20th century.
You bet.
Yeah. So they are not they're not high-ranking people. They're lieutenant colonels and colonels, and because of that, they could fly under the radar, because all the other services, which were also trying to influence all this lobbying, although they were doing it in uniform and out in the open, not under wraps like the Marine Corps was, they would always send generals. So they actually, and this is by their own admission, we deliberately concealed this from the commandant. When he told us stop the lobbying, we saluted smartly and said, aye, aye, sir, and then disregarded it because we knew that the future of the Marine Corps was at risk. And it's, again, it's that underdog mentality. It's a true sense of paranoia that has made this service so focused, cohesive, and effective, not just in warfare, but in areas where it's perhaps a little more troubling to have the military be so effective, which is to say in civilian lobbying, in public relations, in politicking, and indeed in places like Hollywood.
Who were the principals of the Chowder Society? You mentioned Krulak.
Yeah, Krulak is an important one. Probably the most important is Major General Merritt A. Red Mike Edson of Edson's Raiders. He is an interesting, he's effectively the most senior officer. Merrill Twining is another very important mm-hmm. one. Gerald Thomas is on board as well. But Edson's probably the most important and the most tragic figure in the story because he's a Medal of Honor winner from Guadalcanal from the Battle of Edson's Ridge.
Right.
He's a crack shot on the Marine Corps rifle team. He's from a little rural farming town in upstate Vermont, and he joins the Marine Corps. He becomes incredibly important in the Banana Wars. But after World War II, he's just a shoo-in for the commandant. He's the front runner for the commandant as just a major general. It will be coming for him in a few years, everybody is sure. And he gets so upset by what he sees as an attempt not just to sideline and get rid of the Marine Corps, but an attempt by the federal government to expand its power and to start reaching into Congress's, the people's branch, and the prerogatives of the legislative branch, that he resigns so he can testify in front of Congress because he doesn't want to testify in uniform. So he says, that's it, I'll leave the Marine Corps. He testifies vehemently against the unification bill. And then once he has done that, there's so much political pressure on the president when all of a sudden the newspapers say, well, wait a minute, it seems like there's some pretty prestigious military officers who don't think this is a good idea. Once Edson makes his speech, that then results in the president being forced to publicly say, okay, if there's any senior officer that disagrees with this, he can go and testify in front of Congress as well. And then a flood of officers testify, and that's what kills the first bill. Edson will later commit suicide, very sadly, about 6 years later, in 1952, I think. But he was almost certainly going to be the commandant of the Marine Corps sacrificed his career because of a sense that the Marine Corps was under threat, and indeed the nation was under threat from a growing attempt by the president to create a militaristic federal system where the Army would be able to dominate all decision-making if you unify things into a Department of Defense. A misguided concern, but one that he believed very deeply.
I didn't know he committed suicide. I've never heard that. I'm sitting here thinking, have I ever heard of a Marine officer committing suicide like that? Why ultimately did he commit suicide?
Oh, well, one never really knows. It's much later. It's certainly, I can't imagine it has anything to do with unification.
Okay.
But it's
interesting.
It's a sad story.
How does our relationship, which is an actual love affair with Hollywood and the media. I mean, nobody romances like we do. Nobody loves their own story like we love our story. How does that romance affect this story?
It does quite a bit. The Hollywood element of Marine Corps lobbying is a remarkable story and a fascinating one. I like that you use the term romantic because I think it's really important. People wouldn't naturally say, oh, Marines, romantic, what, you know? But actually,
are you
far
kidding?
More than the other services, the Marines are romantics. And I mean that in the 19th century meaning of the term, which is to say, more attuned to feeling than to fact, more attuned to narratives of heroism than to technology. If you look at the military in the 40s and the 50s, if you're going to go on if you're going to go to the Navy, you're going to talk about ships. If you're going to spend time with the United States Air Force or Naval Aviation, you're going to be talking about the equipment, the plane. By the time you get into the late 1950s, you're already going to be talking about missiles and computers. The Marines were always talking about the single man facing down another man, you know, to use our strength and our wits and courage, raw courage, to try to survive. And the commandant once said that the heart of a fighting man is one-fifth ability and four-fifths spirit, and that's what I want in my Marines. So they had very romantic narratives about heroism and courage. Those narratives actually get quite quasi-religious at times, which isn't to say that they are a religion, but if any of your listeners have seen, not too long ago, there was a fabulous recruiting commercial called The Climb, where a Marine is climbing up a face cliff,
right,
and as he gets stuck, he can't get to the top, and all of a sudden, one of the ghosts from Iwo Jima reaches down a hand and pulls him up. They salute each other, and then the World War II ghost evaporates into thin air, goes into the young man, and he becomes a Marine in the dress blues, and he has a sword. This is actually that's not a single-time thing. You find that basic story that the Marine Corps has these ancestors that go before, that everything you do, there's a whole long line of Marines watching you. And they've used those. They've used it in their popular productions and their culture, and it's certainly one of the things that they celebrate. So there's this romantic element to Marine Corps culture that I think has always been fascinating to me. And it explains also why films like Taking Chance, an absolutely beautiful film, which is right, based on a true story about escorting a dead Marine home from Iraq, it's such a powerful and compelling film. But your question is, so how did they get so successful in Hollywood, and how does the Hollywood part play a role in their
can I make a comment on just what you just said? T.X. Hammis was on last week, I think, or the week before, and he was talking about his writings on the Marine Brigade that went to Pusan. And he said, you know, we have this in our mind. We've convinced ourselves that this was this combat season full of World War II veterans group that went. He said it was not.
Nope.
He said one of the battalion or company commanders was an 0301, hadn't even been in the MOS long enough to become an 0302. And
then
I said, how did they do it? He said, Mac, he said, the power of our narrative is incredible. He said, when you read the letters that those guys wrote home, what weighed on them heavily was the narrative that had been written in World War II, and they were not going to let it down, that they did not know what was going to happen, if they were going to die on the Pusan perimeter, but they were going to fight like Marines because they were Marines. And a lot of these guys, he said, hadn't been to boot camp. They were headed towards Korea, and they went to boot camp on the ships en route. And and I said, really? I never heard that. And he said, yeah.
That's
he
true.
Said, it's crazy. He said, but the power of our narrative is huge. Because I said, well, how did that group then make such a difference at Pusan? He said, I would tell you, the legacy of the Marine Corps as it overshadows you. And I would tell you this, when I first went to Ramadi in 2004, I can remember thinking those thoughts, like, look, I don't know what's going to happen, but I don't know how this all works out, but I'll tell you what, I am not going to let down, you know, the Marines that I serve with, and, you know, and everybody who's gone before me. You know, I'm not going to let that legacy down, because you that invisible hand in that commercial, that's no bullshit, and you and I both know that. So it's incredibly powerful to our own culture. So it's tremendously interesting.
Yeah, I felt it in Afghanistan too. I felt it even before I found myself in a combat zone.
Right.
You're absolutely right. That part of what unifies us and drives us forward and shapes our choices is not just the man to the left and the man to the right that exists in all military services, but a very strong sense of community that transcends time and place and living in tech. And I think the Marine Corps does that better than anybody. And that's why it is. That's why we call it the Marine Corps spirit. Give me that old Marine Corps religion, right? These are marching songs. But if you read the literature, if you read the stories written by Marines, if you read just the articles in Leatherneck and Gazette, you're going to find references to spirit, ethos, transcendence, magic. No one can explain these stories better than Rick Spooner, by the way. If any of your readers ever find themselves in Quantico, Virginia, they should go to the Global North restaurant, where there is a living legend to the Marine Corps, Major Rick Spooner, who will unfold for you the tales of how the Marine Corps mystique shapes his life on a day-to-day basis. And the point is that exists everywhere in the Marine Corps, and it's different from the other services.
We're trying to get him to come on.
He's
incredible. My guest this morning is Professor Aaron O'Connell. He currently, what do you teach at Navy?
I teach writing classes. Marine Corps history is one that usually fills up, because about 20% of our of our graduates go into the Marine Corps. Mm-hmm. I also teach naval history, a class on the history of the Navy and the Marine Corps that goes from 1776 to the present. And then after I came back from Afghanistan, I started teaching classes on the Afghanistan War and some classes on civil-military relations in America.
Wow. Interesting. Let's continue with our discussion.
Let me pick up with where you left off with T.X. Hannes' comment about Korea. Right?
Yeah, go ahead.
He's talking about the fact that the reason these young guys, some of whom had never even been to boot camp, that's true, did so well in Korea, and it's because of the inspiration or the weight of the stories of the community that went before. So there's a bright side and there's a dark side to that story, and I think probably one of the chapters I've gotten the most comments on, some positive, some negative, has been the chapter that discusses post-traumatic stress disorder. And the argument I make, which I think is anybody who's been in a combat zone can probably relate to some degree, is that when you have stories about what you're supposed to do and those stories shape your action, all that's well and good if the stories that you've been given are actually achievable. But the stories that the Marine Corps gave its young recruits, and particularly those young recruits that hadn't even been to boot camp, were these superhero myths of what a Marine is supposed to be. And when doctors were treating people in World War II and in Korea for what they then called either battle stress or battle fatigue, they didn't yet call it post-traumatic stress, they noticed a couple things that are worth noting. The first is the Marines had the lowest numbers of combat stress. The reason for that is that the Marines just didn't allow people to admit that they were uncomfortable with what they were doing. They were kicked up to the front line. And the only time they were allowed to evacuate is when they had broken down completely. So the Marine Corps had much higher standards internal to the culture about what toughness was and what duty was. And that meant that you just kept going, or sometimes you were risking violence from your own chain of command if you said, I'm just too frightened, I can't go on. It was not culturally acceptable to say that in any way. On the other hand, the Army, I'm sorry to say, had very loose rules for what they considered, problems with psychological adjustment. So half the people in the Army that would later claim to have psychoneurosis, which is a fancy term they use for this kind of stuff, never even left the United States. They had not been overseas. So differences in terminology are important here. So the Marines had very low rates, the lowest rate. But here's the important part. Because they had these strong stories, when they broke badly. And I want to quote for you a doctor in the Pacific talking about the difference he sees when he treats Marines as opposed to treating other naval officers. As a naval officer, he's only treating Navy and Marines, no Army. But he said that the Marines that come in show, this is a quote, an extraordinary amount of guilt accompanied by a feeling of complete loss of the idealized ego of the Marine Corps. And this, he concluded, makes them hard to treat because, quote, once their defenses broke, some degree of personality disintegration occurred. So just let that sink in for a minute, that these Marines came in with stories of what it means to be a Marine. And when they couldn't live up to those stories, because the culture was so cohesive and those stories were so important, they didn't just feel that they had done a bad job. They didn't just feel that they had let their fellows down. Some degree of personality disintegration occurred. And that happened in both World War II and in Korea. And it's a sort of detailed story of one veteran in particular who I think makes the story come to life.
I had a PFC from Iwo Jima on a month ago named Cal Humphrey, and he was in Alpha Company, 1st Battalion, 27th Marines. And I want to say he got wounded 19 days into the battle. Yeah. And I said, Cal, what makes a good Marine? He said, well, the first thing you got to get over is kind of a funny story before I tell you what he said. I said, what's the best advice you got on Iwo Jima? He said, don't be the first guy out of the fighting hole. And I started laughing. He said, no, he said, it's the truth, man. He said, that was good advice. He said, and then when I said, what makes a good Marine? He said, you got to use your head when you're under pressure. He said, because, you know, they try to fill you up with all that stuff that you're 10 feet tall and invincible. He said, you're not. You're not. And that's exactly kind of the disconnect that you're talking about. And he, you know, on Iwo Jima, living proof that, you know, that those thoughts are his mind was pregnant with those thoughts about, can you live up to this invincible warrior that we all get taught about, and then very much a part of our mythology or our culture, whichever you prefer. Aaron, so continue with the narratives. I'm curious how, well, let me ask you this before. I'm curious about how we get legislation written about the three wings and the three divisions. But before I ask you that, we were talking about Hollywood and the media What role does the movie The Sands of Iwo Jima play in this whole debate?
Yeah, it's very important. So there's three different prongs, if you will, of the Hollywood offensive that make a big difference, and Sands of Iwo Jima and John Wayne are one of those three prongs. So first of all, you know, we always talk about the Marine Corps as being these great celebrators of their stories, these great public relations men, right? There's the joke in an army, a squad is 12 men, and the Marine Corps is 11 men and a press agent, right? Marines are always telling their own stories, they can't stop. But it's important to note that the people, the distributors of the most important stories of Marine Corps culture in this period are mostly civilians. So what are the things you know about the Marine Corps? You know the Iwo Jima image that's right. Photographed by Joe Rosenthal, an AT photographer, and then it's popularized not just by the press, but then eventually by the war bond drive, which is done by the Treasury Department. Those are civilians running that, right? Mm-hmm. Second, the Sands of Iwo Jima, this movie about the Marines. Now, the Marines absolutely participated in making it, and I'll tell you some funny stories about what they did, but that was not generated by the Marine Corps. That was generated by Republic Pictures. That was civilians trying to make money Mark Seven, I think it's the ones that originally did it, by selling a movie, right? So they were in it for their own reason.
Aaron, can you imagine sitting around that discussion? Look at all the people that have gone crazy over this image. If we can make a movie about that, we can get a lot of them to pay $2 or 50 cents to go to it, and we'll laugh all the way to the bank.
That's absolutely right. And then some of the more important later productions that are important to the Marine Corps, things like Jack Webb's The D.I., well, that's not the Marines. The Marines are participate in that, but films like The D.I. were made by civilians. So these important distributions of Marine Corps culture are not done by the Corps, they're civil-military alliances. It's where the Corps partnered with civilians. They could at times shape the direction it took. They could help or hinder, but they did not control them. And that's important to note. So the three prongs that are interesting to watch is the Disney Corporation, which gets involved with the creation of Toys for Tots, and something called the Devil Pup Citizenship Project, which is a fascinating camp for kids in the 50s. Then John Wayne in the Sands of Iwo Jima, and then finally, Jack Webb and the movie The D.I. So Sands of Iwo Jima is made with the active cooperation of the Marine Corps, and it's made in 1949, that very year, what we were discussing before, that budget cuts are looming, and we're unifying all the services, and the various services are worried about losing their political power. All the services try to make more films in Hollywood. The most successful one by far is Sands of Iwo Jima, starring John Wayne. The Marine Corps lends them equipment for the film. The Marine Corps authors exploitation manuals, that's what they actually call them, exploitation manuals for the publicity of the film, which involved all kinds of publicity stunts. They staged displays of gear in theaters. They took possession of when the film arrived in town, the Marine Corps Reserve Unit would like drive the film to the movie theater with pomp and circumstance. They hosted call-in shows and letter writing contests and essay contests, all to sort of pump up the film. All, you know, for free. They did that for the film because it helped them in their recruiting and in their public relations. But because they did all this, they also got a vote on the film. And there's a number of interesting things that you only learn when you start reading through the scripts that the Marine Corps edited and approved in the production process. So since you're in Hollywood, I know, or you're in California, I know that some of your readers will enjoy this. But
you bet.
There's a number of really disturbing things in the Sands of Iwo Jima that are allowed to stay in. But the Marine Corps is like, hey, this is filmic. There's nothing wrong with that. So if we remember, for those seeing the film, Sergeant Stryker is a drunk. John Wayne's character is an absolute drunk. He beats his troops. He has fights with his troops. At one point, he hits one of them with a bayonet, you know, like with a rifle butt while they're trying to do bayonet practice.
Right.
And all of this, the Marine Corps has no problem. They have real footage of combat, which involves showing Japanese being shot and burned alive by flamethrowers. All that's kept in the film. No problem.
Right.
There's one scene the Marine Corps would not allow, and not only did they cut the scene, they rewrote it. And that scene is where John Wayne encounters someone who is probably a prostitute. It's just, you know, it's done subtly in the late 1940s, but a woman drinking alone, all dressed in black at a bar, which is the 1940s, suggests that they adjourn to her house nearby.
Right.
And in the original script, John Wayne gets drunk and punches her. And when the Marines read that, they said, oh, absolutely not. That can't stay in. And so they rewrote it into a really, if you ever want to see the film again, a beautiful little scene where John Wayne instead helps her feed her baby.
And then he leaves money, and when he leaves on his money clip when he walks out the door, right, or something like that.
Yep, he leaves all his money, and he says, don't join the Marine Corps, Mac, and off he goes.
Exactly, you know.
Call him Mac, right?
How else would that end?
Right. So they do that, and the reason they do that is because there actually was quite a lot of problems with people coming home from war and being violent.
Right.
So it's funny to me that the things, you know, that you can see the Marine Corps' areas of concern, where what they'll allow and what they won't allow in that film. So they do. They edit that script, and they get involved with them. They support it, and it makes a lot of money. And it also helps the Marine Corps.
You know what's interesting, Aaron?
Flag raisers.
You know what's interesting, just even in terms of Hollywood, is Frank Capra's movie, The Best Years of Our Life, I think.
Fabulous film.
Right? It's, to me, so surprising when you look at that movie now, that was made and there was such an effort to make an honest depiction of what guys went through as they came home, because you didn't see very much of that at all.
Right.
And even, you know, I remember one of the first things that I saw as a kid who grew up on history and war movies and things like that, in Apocalypse Now, when I believe they're landing that medevac, and there's a black soldier who gets wounded in the thigh, and I don't remember if he was wounded before or after the helicopter explodes, but he is screaming. He's screaming and grabbing his thigh. And I just remember being very disturbed by that because I'd never seen that. In the Sands of Iwo Jima, John Wayne gets shot, you know, and he, boom,
that's
tips
it.
Over
Down
and dies.
That's right.
Right? And you never saw any honest depiction of, you know, the agony, the grabbing, the begging your buddy, don't let me die, all of that, until Apocalypse Now captures some of it. But in The Best Years of Our Lives, I don't know another movie where they depict veterans as struggling with alcoholism,
right.
Feelings of inferiority because of amputations and things like that. And it was so quick after World War II. It's really an amazing work.
It is, yeah. And that film, if those who don't know it, must go out and watch it immediately.
Right.
It's the 1946 Academy Award winning Best Picture.
1946, for God's sake.
46, it's right when they're coming home, yeah.
Right.
And it's William Wyler,
who's
a bit of a grittier director than Frank Capra, I think. but you're absolutely right that movies are mostly meant to entertain. And the Marine Corps understood that, and so they were fine with making a realistic war picture in the sense of not making everything come up roses. But there were some areas where they absolutely couldn't abide honest looking the hard truth in the face about what it's like to come home. Now, the second area where they get involved with Hollywood is the exact opposite of that. There's none of this, like, the hard truth. There's nothing about gritty depictions of war. It's Disney. So I'm sure everybody in America knows what Toys for Tots is, but I don't think everybody knows where it comes from. So Toys for Tots is created by a reserve Marine major who is a public relations man at Warner Brothers Pictures in Hollywood. And he originally starts it. He and his wife start it for the most benevolent purposes. It's 1947. There are quite a number of orphaned children because of World War II. And he thinks, I can't imagine what Christmas would be for kids who lost their father in the war. So they start a program for donating toys to people who've been to the children of those, the war dead. The Marine Corps Reserve picks up on this immediately and says, hey, we're facing budget cuts. They're trying to shut the Marine Corps down. They're trying to take away our Marine divisions. This is a great way to reach the American people and to tell a good news story about the Marine Corps. And this is important because this is at the moment in time when we are keeping a standing military. There's a lot of people saying, wait a minute, whoa, the war's over. Why do we need a standing military? Why is the draft still in effect in 1946? And this is new to Americans. So the Marine Corps does a number of things to try to say, hey, don't worry. We're civilians just like you.
Hold on, Aaron. Aaron, just to add some context, tell everybody, how new to America in 1946 is the concept of these large standing army and the draft?
There's no precedent for it.
And so
there's
maybe
no precedent
what
for a military of that size
less than 10
without a war.
Less than 10 years, right?
Well, it's actually less than 1 year, because what happens is when World War II, we always have a standing army, but it's a tiny army. Most of it throughout the 19th century is working on the frontier, engaged in conflict with Indians. And so there's a reason for it against a specific military threat that makes people say, okay, we can keep that, but it's tiny in size. We then build up a very large military in World War II. It grows to 10 million, but as soon as that's for a specific purpose, we're fighting two wars. As soon as the war is over, we begin demobilizing, but we don't demobilize all the way. And we retain a force that's still bigger than anything we had had in the 19th century. Okay. And we start saying, well, we're not saying we're at war with the Soviet Union, but what we're saying is the Soviet Union is a concern, and we need to occupy all these countries in Europe temporarily until they get back on their feet. So that's incredibly new. In 1946, that is 6 months new. And at the very moment we're doing that, the Marine Corps Reserve gets this authorization to set up reserve units in different towns, and Toys for Tots is a great way to sort of convince people, look, we're not the guys coming back from Iwo Jima who've been traumatized. Don't worry about that. We actually hand out toys to kids. And Walt Disney himself designs the logo for Toys for Tots. So they get, Warner Brothers gets the Disney Corporation involved, gets local businesses involved, and that's why to this day, every year around Christmas time, the Marine Corps now has, Marine Corps Reserve has a formal mission to run the Toys for Tots program.
That's incredible. I had no idea. I mean, I had no idea in terms of the history of Toys for Tots.
Yep. They then later, Disney will get involved again later in something that is also meant to ease the public's mind and to sort of represent the Marine Corps as a community service organization, which is the Devil Pups Citizenship Project. So not devil dogs, adult Marines, but devil pups. Kids, 13-year-olds and teenagers, who are brought to a camp at Camp Pendleton for a summer camp, and Walt Disney's, this time the company, not the man, designs the logo for the Devil Pup Citizenship Program, which I am not kidding you, is Pluto, the dog Pluto, but with horns and a hay fork and a scaly tail to be a devil pup. And they run these 10-day camps for kids, to sort of be like, look, you know, Marines, we're teaching you how to be young, upstanding gentlemen. We're teaching you how to both be tough, but also to be polite. We're bringing the best parts of military discipline to teach you how not to be juvenile delinquents. And they use that specifically to respond to fears in the 1950s that America's boys are either going soft or are becoming juvenile delinquents.
Wow.
Very clever stuff.
Wow. Now, but again, this starts as a local effort in Los Angeles, and then immediately is seized upon by some very shrewd decision maker, probably in Washington D.C., and gets used as a way to make better our image.
Correct. It's all done out of the Bureau of Public Information, which later becomes Bureau of Public Affairs. And it does, and they do it for exactly the reason. You even referenced the quote earlier in our interview, which is a quote that every Marine knows, which is that when the public ceases to care about the Marine Corps will not exist. The nation does not need a Marine Corps. It wants the Marine Corps. So the public relations element of this is front and center in how the Marine Corps manages its brand. And they realize, well, wait a minute, we absolutely need to ease people's concerns that Marines are really violent. And both Toys for Tots and this Devil Pup Citizenship Project are a way to be like, hey, come on, we're just like you. We're fathers and sons and brothers too, which is of course true, but it's very savvy public relations, which
wow.
No other service has come close to duplicating.
My guest today for a few more minutes, and I know we're taking up your time, Aaron, and I certainly appreciate it. Aaron B. O'Connell, professor, United States Naval Academy, historian, writer. And we're talking about his book, Underdogs, The Making of the Modern Marine Corps. Can you, now that you've set the stage, how do we in fact get legislation passed to enact three divisions and three air wings? How the
sure.
hell does that happen?
So there's two stories that are relevant here. First of all, the name of the act is important. It's called the Douglas-Mansfield Act. And it refers to Paul Douglas and Representative Mansfield, who are Mike Mansfield, who are right. prominent Marines in the Congress at the time. But the way that they actually get it passed is by appealing to all people of very different political persuasions. So they build an incredibly impressive congressional coalition. They actually created an organization called the Congressional Marines. And what they did is they had people on the congressional staff, lawyers on the House Armed Services Committee, some retired members or active members of Congress who had been in the Marine Corps, and they created a breakfast club, you know, a lunch. We're gonna get together once a month just to check in with the other Marines. But of course, they used this for lobbying, and they lobbied across the political aisles very successfully. So the opening to the chapter on the passage of this act and the lobbying in Congress tells the story of Paul Douglas, Democrat from Illinois, couldn't be more liberal, the most liberal person in the United States Senate, walking down the aisle, sitting down and shaking hands with Joe McCarthy, perhaps the most conservative member of the United States Senate, and the two men hated each other. And they made a deal on the Marine Corps. They were able to come to terms that they're both going to support this bill on the Marine Corps because even though they could despise each other, they had this common interest in preserving and strengthening the Corps. So a lot of the ways that once McCarthy signed on, all the conservatives signed on as well, and that the bill was so popular, it passed by voice vote. They didn't even have to do a roll call because they had 51 sponsors in the Senate. There was a majority of senators sponsoring the bill so that they didn't even need to vote on it because everybody had already passed it. So the first thing they did is they just lobbied very, very well. The second thing is to return to our earlier conversation of how they sometimes broke the rules. They did some really clever things. So here's a fun story, I think. So one member of this Congressional Marines group was a lawyer on the House Armed Services Committee. And he worked on the professional staff. He's a civilian, that's his job, but he's also a reserve Marine. And so because he's a reserve Marine, he has the inside scoop on all the legislation that's about to be passed. And he knows that this affects the Marine Corps. He calls up the Bureau of Legislative Affairs in the Marine Corps and says, hey, they're going to pass this bill. You should have some congressmen come down to Quantico and do a tour, like show them around Quantico. He says, now, here's the thing. When you do this, you got to do three things. Because the whole point here is to convince them that we need money, that we're out of money and that we really need an increase in funding. Here's what you're going to do. First thing is, close the commissary. The day they come down there, don't let the commissary be open because they're going to go in, they're going to see how good it is. They're going to see how much good stuff we have in the commissary. Our life isn't that bad. So close the commissary. Tell them it's closed for inventory. Second, I'm not kidding. Go down to the stables, find all the horses, hide the horses. Move the horses to another pasture so they don't know we have horses for riding for recreation. Because that's too luxurious. You don't want them to see that. Then the third thing he says is, at the end of the day, you're going to have a reception for all those congressmen. Don't serve them crab cakes and whiskey and all these fine things. Go buy some Cutty Stark. Buy the worst, cheapest whiskey you can find and have stale crackers. And then this is a quote. He says, and on the way back on the bus, I'm telling you, it works. I heard one congressman say, my God, they need a pay raise. Have you ever tasted such whiskey? So, I mean, they were incredibly savvy in how they got Congress on their side. And they continue to be that way today. If you go to any hearing, you could go to a personnel subcommittee readiness hearing inside the House of Representatives on a Wednesday morning at 11 a.m. And there'll be a Marine sitting in the audience just taking notes, just making sure that Legislative Affairs and the Commandant of the Marine Corps knows what Congress is doing when it comes to the Marine Corps. They're very savvy with their political outreach.
By the way, they don't lobby. It looks a lot like lobbying, but they inform and advise. They don't lobby because lobbying is against the law. I was lectured by that by a very good friend of mine who's the head of the Office of Legislative Affairs, Brigadier General Dave Furness. It looks a lot like it, but it's not. And that's an important distinction, Mac. I said, okay, how does all of this affect us institutionally and culturally going forward? Because, you know, if again, reference, everybody's seen the pictures of the jaunty covers on Marines, the way our hair is not even close to what they wore in World War II, the way our uniforms were not, you know, but out of this, what do we become as an institution and how does this impact our culture?
I think it does a few things. The first is the sort of severity of Marine Corps life. The high stakes, and those stakes have only gotten higher over the last 15 years of constant wars. the severity of the life, the high stakes, the extremity of the stakes involved in being and serving as a Marine, it adds something to the way that Marines think about the organization they belong to and the value they place on it. I think that's important. I think a lot of people grow up in America thinking that if I get a good job and if I basically don't have to worry about my health or my safety or my financial resources, well then that's enough. That's a life well lived. The Marine Corps has never accepted that. Most services don't. I mean, martial cultures don't accept that. So the Marine Corps takes very seriously the idea that what you do matters, and you better care about what you do enough to potentially give your life for it. That's something that's very powerful in the Catholic faith. In a different way, it's very powerful in the Marine Corps. There are narratives of self-sacrifice that give people a sense of belonging and a sense of meaning in their lives that
purpose
probably were always there, but they're front and center in the Marine Corps today. And so I think that's part of why there's so much, you know, the uniforms are almost monastic. The head shaving is, you're going to get this, you know, you're going to have a haircut once a week. There's no compromise on that. Those are all symbols that are revelations of or exemplars to the degree of commitment that people feel about the Marine Corps. I think that's important.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing that it's done, though, is as the Marine Corps has gotten more powerful in American society and in Congress, and in foreign policy, is it's expanded the tools for foreign policy available to the president. And this is bringing us back to where we started our conversation today when you asked, my gosh, if you look at the wars after World War II, Korea, Vietnam, Somalia, Grenada, Iraq, Afghanistan, you don't see too many success stories. I think it's fair to say that The final chapter of the book is about how once the Marine Corps not only survives World War II, but ends up building these Marine Air Ground Task Forces and building up standing forces that can deploy anywhere in the world in just a matter of hours to reinforce diplomacy, you find that presidents start using the military more often to do things that aren't all-out war. You start landing Marines in Lebanon in 1958, in the Dominican Republic in 1965. In Vietnam in 1965 and for 10 years, there's 215 moments where the military is used as an instrument of foreign policy between World War II and sort of the late Cold War.
Wow.
That's kind of new in American society and in American life. And it raises as many concerns as it does questions, because not many of those, some of those small moments are undoubtedly successful. I mean, Grenada in 83, we had set out to achieve a specific thing and we accomplished it. You can't really say the same for many other military operations.
Right. One of the things I've learned in doing this program for now, we started All Marine Radio on June 1st, and our mission is post-combat-related mental health, to give guys a place to listen to where they can be part of the tribe that has been so significant in their life and not go down kind of that path of isolation, and then the bad things that happen to that when you go down that path. So we're here every day. This is, this show is about the culture of the Marine Corps. And, one of the things that I've learned that I think is very significant in the lives of Marines, especially, combat veterans, is a purpose-driven life. That when they leave the Marine Corps and they don't find purpose in employment, they struggle tremendously, and in that idle mind that's not engaged with their work, where their creative mental involvement is not happening, that their mind slews back to often a bad place. And so it's interesting what you said about a purpose-driven life, that you know that is what a life in the Marine Corps is about. And guys gravitate and girls gravitate to the Marine Corps for that reason. It's interesting, I think, one of the things I've learned, that when they leave the Marine Corps, they look for that purpose again. And those who can't find it, be it in the private sector or going back into work either for state or federal, local government, those who can't find it struggle tremendously. Because for most Marines, it's not simply about making money. Although they like money, yeah. for a lot of them, if it's not contributing to their happiness, and we would define, I think, happiness different than a lot of people do, they struggle. And I think it's an interesting kind of parallel that to be drawn in terms of the purpose-driven life that you feel while on active duty. If you don't find that when you separate from the Marine Corps, I think it contributes to certainly to bad mental health and poor outcomes. So people looking to read this, when they put this book down, Aaron, give me a couple things you hope that they'll be smarter about relative to the Marine Corps.
Okay, well, I think so. Some of it is things I'd hope they'd be smarter about, and then other things really don't have much to do with you know, new information or like intellect or smartness, but just maybe a different way of looking at things.
Okay.
So the first is I think even those of us who've been in the Marine Corps for 20 years, as much as you love the Marine Corps, it's okay to be honest. it's okay to acknowledge. It's okay to admit when the Marine Corps has been fantastic and when it has not. And that was part of the title too, right? Underdogs. The idea is to sort of look underneath the Devil Dogs mythology and to realize that there's some myth making here. There's some hype here. And the Marine Corps doesn't need fake accolades. It has enough of its own real and genuine accolades that we don't need to make up stories. So when the Marine Corps, you know, loves to celebrate November 10th, 1775, we love to celebrate that as the Marine Corps birthday. As a historian, I got to tell you, it's important to note that absolutely nothing happened on 10 November 1775. Continental Congress passed a resolution for Marines it never raised, and no Marine went into uniform on 10 November 1775. There's no Marines anywhere in the world that go into uniform until November 28th. That matters. Facts matter, right? So we can have our mythology. We can have these wonderful stories about the Marine Corps, but it's okay to be honest about them, and that's part of the book, is debunking some of the myths, and then showing that the Marines were very successful at managing a brand, and that brand wasn't always based entirely in fact. In some ways, I think a fun way to put it is that some Marines are a little bit more loyal to the Corps than they are to the fact. So that's one thing I hope that people will take away, that they'll take away that some of these stories have only a grain of truth in them, and that a lot of this is savvy brand management. Another thing I would like your readers to take away, particularly if they have struggled with mental health or have had experiences in the Marine Corps that are causing them to suffer or to deal have friction in their day-to-day living now that they're back from Iraq and Afghanistan. I spent a lot of time talking about that in the book pertaining to Korea and World War II. There's a chapter on post-traumatic stress, and there's a chapter about Marine Corps culture and how it's both helpful and harmful for people dealing with the aftermath of war. The best description I ever heard of identity is that all we really are when we come down to having an identity is it's the stories we tell ourselves and others about ourselves. Right? We have a set of stories we use. This is who I am. This is what I believe. And the Marine Corps, when you join, hands you a ready set made of stories, which are very effective for some purposes. They're very effective for keeping you moving forward in dangerous situations. They're very effective for helping you to work together with other Marines. They aren't always as effective in situations outside of combat and outside of Marine Corps life. And it's okay to branch outside of those initial narratives and to create your own new narratives about yourself. So there's something wonderful about feeling the community of Marines living and dead that are saying, you're one of us, and we're one of you, and we're all here together. It is not helpful when those ghosts haunt. It is not helpful when you're hearing voices telling you you're not a good Marine, or you're only good while you're in the Marine Corps. All of us need to be able to take the stories of the Marine Corps that have been productive for us, but move beyond them as our own selves. And I would hope that maybe by reading the book, some readers might hear of some journeys to healing that some of the characters in the book go through trying to deal with just those things.
Wow, that's an awesome thought. Let me, Aaron O'Connell, our guest, for a few more minutes. First of all, let me ask you a few quick questions, okay?
Sure.
First, Marine Corps, on active duty, how are we doing relative to post-combat related mental health? Is it okay to put your hand up and say, hey, I need help and not be, and not suffer repercussions professionally?
It absolutely is. And it's radically different from when I first joined the Marine Corps in the 1990s. And I imagine when you joined in the 80s, then I'm sure you remember all you had is a battalion surgeon. Now the mental health resources are much more expansive. And, no, it's absolutely okay to ask for help in the Marine Corps today.
All right. Give me a book to read.
Give you a book to read. I would read. I'll tell you. I'll give you a book, and then I'll give you an HBO documentary to watch. The book is Sebastian Junger's Tribe on Belonging and Homecoming, which is exactly on these issues. Sebastian Junger, you might know, is the documentary filmmaker who did Restrepo. He's an absolutely beautiful writer. I can't recommend him highly enough. And then he did a documentary called The Last Patrol, which is on HBO, which is him and two of his friends walking the train track. Remember Stand By Me from the 1980s?
I do.
That's what they're doing. They're walking the train tracks from Washington, D.C. to New York and talking about war and coming home and fathers and combat. And it's just an absolutely beautiful documentary. And the two are connected, right? So a lot of the themes in the book were developed while he went on this walking trip, which he explicitly did to try to let go of war reporting, which had been his job before. And he thought that by walking on the train tracks where they would get hunted down by the Amtrak police, that it would actually have just enough excitement, just enough of the danger of combat that he would not get bored by it.
You know, he was on the show talking about the book Tribe. And,
oh, is that right? Yeah.
And, in fact, we called to see, you know, he sent me a very nice email saying, hey, what a wonderful experience, he said, he said, I'll come back anytime. And then we talked to his publicist, and they said, no, we love All Marine Radio, profound and profane. And which I thought, that's awesome. We're doing it right because that's the Marine Corps.
Yeah.
All right, so great book. Give me a leader in history that you admire and why.
You know, it's a funny thing because here I've just spent a whole bunch of time telling you about how Dwight D. Eisenhower wanted to get rid of the Marine Corps. I'm a huge Eisenhower fan. I think he is not only been one of our best presidents, but I think he is something of a extinct species today, which is a fiscal conservative, social progressive, military experienced, savvy politician who is also, by all accounts, a genuinely decent human being. And I wish we had more of that in our country today.
All right, give me a quote that you like.
Ooh. Now you're putting me on the spot.
There you go. You're a smart guy. I thought I could do that.
Yeah, you could. Maybe that's possible. Give me another question, and I'll think of a quote before we get to the end of the show. How's that?
Okay. favorite food.
Favorite food. All right, that's a strange one. Pesto, without a doubt.
Are you kidding me?
I love it. Love it.
Unbelievable. Favorite musical act.
Ah, that's easy. So I've been a bluegrass musician for over two decades. I listen to bluegrass every day. It's one of the things I love the most. And I could really listen to Gillian Welch or Tim O'Brien all day long.
Did not know that.
No.
Two final questions. First one, what makes a good Marine?
A lot of things make a good Marine. That's the thing, isn't it? There, to say that there's one thing would be unhelpful, I think. But certainly what makes a good Marine, I think one thing is you have to embrace the challenge of hardship with a belief that your ability to endure hardship makes you a better person. I firmly believe that.
Very good. Should general officers endorse political candidates? Should retired general officers endorse political candidates?
They should not. I think General Dempsey, a former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, wrote a very fine article on this recently.
Yep.
And I think he said it as well as anybody can say it. It's very important for the military to remain apolitical. Otherwise, it will too quickly turn its considerable popularity in American life into something that probably broaches over into militarism, which I think is unhealthy.
Okay. When you come back, I want to talk to you about that, though, because, you know, Eisenhower, Washington, Grant, William Henry Harrison, all the Civil War generals that became presidents of the United States, we have a tradition in the country of, well, we have a history in the country of generals becoming political. And so I want to talk about that and where this line extends, because it's okay to go into the, I'll use an Eisenhower term, the military-industrial complex and work in the procurement process and make millions of dollars on the down low, but to participate in public discourse about politics is somehow or other frowned upon. So I find it a very, very interesting subject, not one that we could treat in short order, but I'd love to have you back and have you talk about that, because I find it a very, very interesting subject. And now your answer for your quote.
Yeah, actually, how helpful that your earlier question prompted, gave me my answer when you asked me, you know, what makes a good Marine, and I started talking about the benefits of suffering. I've always loved it. It's from Aeschylus, and the reason I love it, I learned it first. This is a quote that Bobby Kennedy used on the night that Martin Luther King was shot and killed in Memphis. He was giving a speech, and he opened up, he found out just before he went on stage, and he opened up to this crowd of mostly African American. He announced that Martin Luther King had been killed, and then he started talking about that he too knows the pain of an assassin's bullet, and he's calling appeals for calm and saying, please don't riot, because riots broke out all over America. And in the end, he quoted from Aeschylus, and he said this quote that I memorized a long time ago, just I thought it was so beautiful, but it goes to this very point about what suffering and what hardship in life can bring you. So maybe particularly for those of your listeners who are sometimes struggling, this might be helpful, but here's the quote. It goes, he who learns must suffer, and even in our sleep, pain that cannot forget falls drop by drop upon the heart. And in our own pain, despite our will, comes wisdom to us by the awful grace of God. Always been inspired by that quote.
Wow. You know, I remember hearing that audio. I remember hearing that audio, and he has to calm the crowd down, yes?
That's right. Yeah, yeah. He's worried about riots, and there are already, those are already starting to happen around the country. And even here where I live in Washington, D.C., the very neighborhood I live in was mostly burned to the ground.
Wow.
But it's really an important quote, right? That through suffering comes wisdom, that pain falls drop by drop upon the heart until against our will, our own wisdom comes. The awful grace of God.
He gave
something that's useful.
He was a senator from the state of New York at the time. He was in Indianapolis that night when he did that. So, wow, very interesting. I'm going to dig that up and I'll play it here in a few minutes. So, first of all, Aaron, it's an absolute pleasure to have met you. And I want to thank you for giving up your time today to us here on All Marine Radio. And I will tell you, this radio station is devoted to the culture of the Marine Corps, our tribe. And so I don't know there's been a more, other than Younger's book, maybe, called Tribe. And he never appropriately footnoted him stealing that from me, by the way. But and he refuses to even acknowledge it, which is even worse. But your book about the making of our modern culture here in the Marine Corps is something that I would say that most Marines certainly ought to read, because it is so compelling. And it is, it points directly to how we came to be the way we are, which is tremendously significant. So thank you very much for coming on today. And I hope in the not too distant future, you don't mind if I darken your doorstep and ask you to come back on.
Sure, Matt. I'd be happy to. It was great talking to you. And the next book is coming out in a few months, called Our Latest Longest War, Losing Hearts and Minds in Afghanistan. And I'd be more than happy to come and talk about that when it comes out.
I'd love to talk about that. Aaron B. O'Connell from Connecticut, Marine officer, currently in the United States Marine Corps Reserve, living in Washington, D.C., an associate professor at the United States Naval Academy, and a guest here this morning on All Marine Radio. We'll be back after this on All Warrior Radio Network.